Okay, it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Ken Zeeskind, who has been a professor at Northwestern University in Chicago for over 30 years. He received his PhD at Yale. He's been the head of the Department of Philosophy, the director of the Jewish Studies Program, the director of the Center of the Writing Arts. He has published numerous articles and books, including the one he'll be talking about, Searching for a Distant God. He has also won quite a number of awards for teaching excellence. I don't have to tell you that not every great professor and great scholar is necessarily a great teacher. So this here is not our case, and he has actually won awards for his teaching excellence. We'll also mention that Rabbi Aaronson is here. We are colleagues at CHAT, right next door, and I don't know if Dr. Zeeskind is aware of this, but in the course of philosophy that he teaches in the grade 12 students, there are a number of readings from your writings that are used in the school. CHAT is the biggest high school in North America, so I just want to make you aware of that. And without further ado, I'll introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Zeeskind.
Thank you very much for coming, and my sympathies to all of you for the hockey strike. I don't know how you're getting on. We can begin with something really what will be the focus of this whole lecture, and that is that Maimonides had a problem, and he thought that we have a problem too. So what is that problem? And it's this. When he looked at Judaism of his time, he thought that it had gone astray. He thought that it had gone off onto the wrong path and that it had shortchanged itself intellectually. Now, when I say the Judaism of his day, what I mean is Judaism as practiced, the practice of Judaism. And why had it gone astray? Because he thought it, in some important way, was missing God. And, of course, if you miss God, let's face it, you've missed the whole thing. His challenge to his contemporaries, and I will argue his challenge to us as well, is to try to get Judaism back on the right path and in some way to rediscover God. As Professor Diamond said, Maimonides sees Judaism as having peaks and valleys, and I'll let you decide whether we're at a peak or a valley. But what we're going to try to do is to rediscover God, and in order to do that, you have to see that, according to Maimonides, for the most part, Judaism is a system of thought. The ethnic dimension of Judaism is, for him, relatively unimportant. And we saw that just a few minutes ago in the discussion of converts. The mere fact that you have Jewish blood coursing through your veins is, for Maimonides, does not mean that you are any closer to God. In fact, he thinks that the problems that affect all people affect Jews equally well. The purpose of the religion for him is not to induce feelings of ecstasy. It's not to induce feelings of merriment or comfort. That may, if you get that stuff, so much the better. But that's not really what Judaism is here for. It's really to help you reflect. It's really to improve your mind. The practices of Judaism, the prayers, the dietary laws, the holidays, of course, he's convinced you have to do them. They're mandatory. But his point about that is they are not ends in themselves. You observe the holidays, you observe Shabbat, you wear a kippah, you follow the dietary laws in order to promote reflection, in order to promote intellectual growth. So if Judaism is a system of thought, what is the basis of that system of thought? And here, the answer is very simple. Surprisingly simple. All of Judaism, Maimonides thinks, stands or falls on the first two commandments. The first one, I am the Lord thy God. Second one, you shall have no other gods before me, not make any manner of graven image or likeness of me in heaven, on earth, or in the waters. So let us say that as far as Maimonides is concerned, Judaism stands or falls on the basis of two things. The affirmation of monotheism and the rejection of idolatry. That's our great contribution to world culture. And that's what it means to be a Jew for him. So the question then is, well, if that's the case, if it really all stands or falls on the first two commandments, what is the problem? Don't we all affirm monotheism, and don't we all reject idolatry? I mean, look, this is, seems simple. As for the former, let's face it, we say the Shema twice a day. What could be simpler? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Why did this guy have to come all the way from Chicago up here to Toronto to tell us about monotheism? After all, you can just, if you want, just look at the etymology of the word. Monotheism. Okay, Seaskin? One God. What could be clearer to anyone than the fact that Judaism's contribution to world culture is that it rejected a pagan world in which there were 12 deities or 15 deities and asserted that there's only one, monotheism. As for the rejection of idolatry, let's face it, not even the most wayward Jew that I know has a little drawer with idols tucked away. And when no one's looking in the middle of the night, sort of pulls the shades, open up the drawer, get out the idols, and is tempted to bow to a piece of clay. So what is the problem? Well, here's why I came from Chicago. This is what I want to try to persuade you of. If you believe that what monotheism means is belief in one God, as opposed to 12 or 15, then I put it to you, you are not a monotheist as Maimonides understands the term. You are not. And if that's what you believe, if that's what you're thinking when you say the Shema, one God as opposed to 15, then you have not observed the first commandment. Now, to understand this, we have to understand the challenge that Maimonides is giving us. According to him, if you worship with an improper conception of God, let's say an improper conception of monotheism, if you worship with an improper conception of God, then according to him, you aren't worshiping God at all. And if you aren't worshiping God at all, according to him, you are cut off from Israel, and you have no share in the world to come, regardless of whatever else you may do. Regardless of how often or how fervently you pray, regardless of whether you are Shomer Shabbos, regardless of how many of your holding of the holidays and the rest of the commandments, if your conception of God is imperfect, you have no share in the world to come and you are not part of Israel. So if you want to think of it this way, the reason that I came from Chicago is to try to help you get back into the world to come, okay? Or at least as Maimonides understands it. So to see what's involved in monotheism, let me ask you to perform a kind of a thought experiment. I want you to imagine for a minute or two that you are living in a pagan culture. If you want, let's make it ancient Greece. And according to Homer, there were 12 gods and goddesses running around on the top of Mount Olympus. I want you to imagine that you think that of that 12, all but one are fake. In other words, you think there are 11 fakes and one real deity. So you believe that Zeus is the only god. And you believe that Zeus is basically characterized exactly the way Homer did. You make statues of him. He does everything that Homer said about it. So you believe in the sole divinityship of Zeus. All right? Question, does that make you a monotheist? Because after all, you believe in one god. Doesn't monotheism mean just belief in one deity? And therefore, if you believe in one pagan deity, does that qualify you as a monotheist? Now, I hope you can see that the answer to this better be no. It does not. And if the answer is no, then that raises the question, well, then what is the difference? What is the difference between the monotheism that Judaism teaches and ascribes and what I would call single deity paganism? Or if you want to think of it in another way, what is the difference between monotheism, properly so called, the monotheism of the Shema, and monolatry? Well, the first thing that Maimonides wants you to see is this. There's more to monotheism than just arithmetic. Yes, of course Judaism believes that there's one God as opposed to 12, of course. But it believes in much more than that. So if I can use philosophic parlance for a minute, I'm going to try to keep my philosophic technical terms to an absolute minimum, but let's use a little bit. What a philosopher would say about this is that the arithmetical part is a necessary condition for being a monotheist, but not of itself sufficient. That is to say that there has to be more than just a numerical claim. We need something stronger. And Maimonides' point about what we need that's stronger is this, that the one God that there is does not resemble anything else in the universe. Now, you couldn't have said that about Zeus. He looked like us, he talked like us, he had human emotions, he ate like us, he drank like us, he had sexual urges, etc., etc. That's why belief in him would be idolatry. So what Maimonides says is that it's not just one as opposed to 12, but it's the one that there is unique, is utterly different than anything else in the universe. So what I propose to do now is to try to explain what he means by uniqueness. And to understand that, we could look, for example, just very briefly at the wording of the second commandment. The second commandment says, look, you can't make any images of God. It's not that there are good images and bad images. It's that they all stink. In other words, they're all terrible. I don't care whether it's coming from the sky or the water or the land. They all fail because if God doesn't resemble anything found on earth, then God is not a glorified version of something found on earth. not a glorified version of an animal, not a glorified version of an astronomical body, and of course, most important, not a glorified version of a human being. Now, whenever I say that God is not a glorified version of a human being, I'll tell you who comes to mind. Well, in addition to Maimonides, a person who comes to mind is a Greek philosopher named Xenophanes. Xenophanes was an interesting person. He was what I would call a proto-Jew. In other words, Xenophanes was someone who was not Jewish but who should have been. If you ever invite me up here again, I'll start giving a lecture on people who were Jewish but who should not have been, okay? But, okay, in any event, Xenophanes was not a Jew, but he should have been. And the reason that he should have been is that here's what he said. He said, it's a funny thing, if you think about it, because the Thracians believe that God has blue eyes and red hair. And that's how they depict God. The Ethiopians believe that God has dark eyes, short black hair, and a snub nose. And if horses believed in God, you'll never guess how they would depict God. Best guess, they would depict God with two big ears, a long snout, four legs, and a tail. So, in other words, his claim is that what all of these cultures did was to take their own image and project it into heaven. To say, in effect, that God was just a glorified version of them, which is, after all, just a way, sort of narcissistic. It's a way of patting yourself on the back. God is just like me, or I'm just like God. So according to Maimonides, you can sin against the second commandment not just by bowing to a piece of clay. You can sin against the second commandment in your mind. Indeed, that's where most of the sinning against the second commandment occurs. If you pray, no matter how fervently, to an image of a man or a woman sitting on a throne in heaven, then you have broken the second commandment, and once again, you have no share in the world to come. Now, at one point in the Guide of the Perplexed, Maimonides goes even further. This is, in fact, my favorite part of the whole book, because he asserts the following paradox. He says, it is not true that God is wiser than I am. It is not true that God is better than I am. It is not true that God is stronger than I am. It is not true that God lasts longer than I will. And that anyone who thinks that these things are true has thoroughly missed the point. Well, what is that point? If God were wiser than I am, it would make sense to put God and me on the same scale of comparison. It would make sense to say that I have a quality and that God just has more of it. It would make sense to say that the difference between God and me is that God has a higher IQ. And that's just ridiculous. Because that's to assume that God's intelligence is like mine. And that's to assume that it makes sense to compare us. Einstein's IQ, I assure you, was greater than mine. But we're both human beings, and you can make such a comparison. He was a smarter guy. Arnold Schwarzenegger is stronger and more powerful than Seeskin because he, again, is a human being. It makes sense to compare us. But, well, here, I will admit, several times a week I go to the gym. I do lift weights, I admit. But whatever power, ladies and gentlemen, that God manifests, the power to create whole galaxies out of nothing is completely different, totally incomparable to the ability to lift a few pounds of iron above your head. And if you don't see it that way, let's try yet another way. There was once a movie that I liked a lot. It was called The Crimson Tide. Anybody ever see that movie? The Crimson Tide wasn't about Alabama football. It's really about the U.S. Navy, starring Denzel Washington, Gene Hackman, and the guy who plays Tony Soprano. Has a supporting role in the movie, for trivia's sake. Crimson Tide begins with the following way. You have a blank screen, and the narrator's voice comes out and says this. The three most powerful things in the universe are, one, God. Two, the President of the United States. Three, the commander of a U.S. nuclear attack submarine. Now, I know this is Canada, and I don't know what your opinion of President Bush is. I won't even tell you how I voted. How about that? You can figure it out for yourself. But I ask you to consider for a moment what is involved in the claim that if you start with President Bush, all you have to do is go up one more notch and you get to God. Or, alternatively, if you start with God, all you have to do is go down one more notch and you get to President Bush. Whatever you think of the man, tain't so. And that's what Maimonides is objecting to. And as far as Scripture goes, or as far as our liturgy goes, you can see, I think, what he's trying to explain. Mi chomocha bo elim Adonai, who is like unto you, to which the only possible Jewish answer could be ein chomocha. There's just simply nothing. Nothing at all resembles you. Or if you don't want to look at it that way, what is to say, in effect, the same thing? What is it, Isaiah chapter 40? What does the prophet say? To whom will you liken me that I should be compared? No leader on this earth, not the cedars of Lebanon, no animal, nothing. Why? Because next to God, everything is for naught. It's zero. No grounds for comparison. Now that's, to some extent, that was actually the easy part of my lecture. Let's go into a harder part. And again, I want to stay with this theme of uniqueness and the inability of us to project our image into heaven. If Maimonides is right, then God has no emotion. God is completely devoid of emotion. He knows as well as we do that there are passages in the Torah that say God is angry or jealous or so on and so forth. But Maimonides says we can't take those literally. God doesn't experience emotion because if God were to experience emotion, then God would be basically just a glorified version of a human being. So do not attribute your emotions or my emotions to God. Doesn't work that way. God is not, according to Maimonides, a judge who sits in heaven and can be swayed by begging and pleading. Now again, he knows perfectly well that the High Holiday Machzor has a lot of passages which make it sound pretty much like that. But he says you can't take those literally. They can't be literal or actual descriptions of God, lest we project our own image into heaven. God is not our friend. Sorry. But that's not the role that God plays. Not for Maimonides, at least. Doesn't mean that God hates us, but friendship isn't what's involved here. And so too, God is not a king or a queen or a master or a teacher or a friend or a spouse, really. That's right, it says Ein Kelohim. But all of these are what? They're descriptions that are taken from human experience. They are social relations that describe the connection between one human being and another. And the descriptions of God that way are there for a purpose. They're to help us. But Maimonides believes that eventually we must see that they're not literally true. Eventually we have to see that the relation between God and us is not comparable to the relation between us and any other human being, no matter how powerful or how beloved. In fact, I told you this would be harder. Maimonides thinks that all praise and description of God eventually fails. Now, that doesn't mean that he believed we should stop praying. Far from it. What he did believe was, don't just think that you can pick up the prayer book and look at the descriptions and that all of these can be taken in an actual or literal sense. Prayer is needed to educate. It's needed to induce feelings of reverence. It's needed to make a separation between what we do when we pray and what we do in the workaday week. But strictly speaking, says Maimonides, God is beyond our ability to praise. Because any praise that we could possibly offer would be a praise based on a human scale. And God is not on any scale that we are on. Now, some people believe that you can solve this problem simply by using superlatives. The greatest of the great, the mightiest of the mighty, the wise, I mean, just on and on and on. And, of course, his answer to that would be, don't be silly. The mere fact that you use a superlative doesn't make any difference at all. And at this point, actually very interesting, in the Guide of the Perplexed, at this point, he quotes Rabbi Hanina, who says, look, imagine a king who possessed lots of gold. And you praised the king for possessing lots of silver. Well, for most of us, to be praised for possessing lots of silver would be nice praise. But in the case of God, it would be an insult. So when we praise God, it is in effect like praising someone who has gold for possessing silver. And if you said, well, then what am I supposed to do? How do I praise God? Maimonides says that the highest form of praise to God is silence. The highest form of praise to God is to recognize, eventually, that no praise that we can offer will possibly work. And that is indeed what true praise is all about. All right? Let's get harder still. I told you this is a challenge. I mean, this we'd be damned to say, what's the problem? Well, there are a lot of problems here. If you think about what I've said so far, you will see that most of what I've said in the name of the Rambam has been a negation. God is not X. God is not Y. God's not our friend. God's not our teacher. God's not our spouse. God's not our king. God's not our queen. God is on and on and on. I've said that our praise and description of God fails. That's negative. So you ask, well now hold on a second. How can we ever really know God? And Maimonides' answer is, to a great extent, we can't. To which you say, wait a minute, this is Meshuggah. How can you have a religion that is founded on what we can't know and what we can't say and comparisons that we can't make? Maimonides calls this, as philosophers sometimes do, negative theology. His theology is negative. Now, it doesn't mean that he's got a negative view of life. What? Well, it's not even process of elimination, because how many people are in the room? What, 50 people? If I started playing process of elimination, suppose you played a quiz game with me, you know, who is the person who's got the prize in his or her pocket? By process of elimination, I could eliminate 49, and then I know that the last one is the person. But Maimonides doesn't even think we can do process of elimination with God, because once again, God is off the scale. And this sounds crazy. And in answer to this, I ask you to consider three things. Number one, I've been a teacher at a university for 32 years. I often teach freshmen. Why? Because I love to teach freshmen. They're bright and fresh and young, and I get crazy questions, but I like those bright, young, fresh faces. I'm teaching freshmen right now, back in Evanston. Funny thing about freshmen, they know everything. It's amazing. They're 18 years old. There is nothing they don't know the answer to. So what I tell them on the first day of class is, this is going to be an interesting class, because I hope that when this class is over, you are more ignorant than when you entered. I hope that you know less than you do today. And in fact, having taught this subject for so long, I got to tell you, I know a lot less than you do. So maybe what we should do is distinguish between two kinds of ignorance. Let's call one simple ignorance, by which I really mean just the ignorance of the fool. And let's call another learned ignorance. Learned ignorance would be the ignorance of a wise person who, having studied something for years, realizes his or her limitations, realizes just how much there is in this field that he or she does not know, and openly admits it. Now, I think that what Maimonides wants us to get us to, vis-a-vis God, is a state of learned ignorance. He wants us to realize, of course, that God is not material. He wants us to realize that God is not comparable to a human being. But he also wants us to realize that when it comes to really knowing God, none of us do, and ever really will. And that anyone who claimed, "I know all about God, I know exactly what God is making the mistake of either taking himself or herself and raising it up to God's level, or perhaps even worse, I don't know, taking God and bringing God down. If you want a scriptural justification for Maimonides' view, there is one passage that he loves. Whenever I read him talking about this passage, I always say to myself, you know what, from Maimonides' standpoint, it's a good thing that this passage is in the Torah. If this passage weren't in the Torah, he might have even greater problems. But that passage is Exodus 33, which, if you know it, Moses is on the mountaintop and says to God, "If I have found favor with you, show me your ways." And God says, "Well, I'm very sorry, but you can't see my face. Actually, no human being can see my face and live." And the first time I read that passage, I was sort of back in doing Greek mythology, and I thought that what the Torah was saying is that God was like Medusa. If you remember, she was so ugly that if you looked at her, you immediately died. And who was it? Perseus had, when he came, he put up a mirror so he didn't look directly at her, cut off her head, put it in a big sack, and that's how he... Okay. Well, thank heavens I went to college and read Maimonides and got a higher understanding of the passage, because Maimonides says, "You can't see my face" means you can't really know me. You, Moses, the greatest prophet who will ever live, cannot really know who or what I am. I will always be something of a mystery to you. But since you have found favor in my sight, I'll tell you what. If you stand behind that rock over there, you can see my backside, and I will cause all of my goodness to pass in front of you. Well, what do you mean, God's backside? What could that mean? And here, what Maimonides says it means is that we can't know what God is, but we can know what God has done. We can't know the actor, but we can know the action. Let me explain. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that there's a millionaire, a well-meaning millionaire in the community. And as I look out on the audience, let me just say, if there's a millionaire in the audience, I hope you're paying very close attention. Okay? Let's suppose that this millionaire makes a tremendous gift to the community. So let's suppose that in 6 months after the gift, we have new libraries of Judaica, we have more courses, we have more lecture series, we have no more problems with building funds, we have more work being done at Jewish hospitals, at Jewish community centers, etc. It's all the way down the line. Because this person has made a huge gift to the community. Let's suppose, in addition, that the gift is made completely anonymously. Now, I put it to you, if that were the case, we would know what the person has done in the sense that we would know the good that had been accomplished. We would see that all around us. And we could praise it. We would not know, and perhaps would never know, the identity of the donor. We would have no idea who this was, really. Now, I think if this is helpful, that's the way Maimonides thinks we approach God. We can see the goodness that God has made or produced in the universe. But we don't know the identity of God, and true wisdom would amount to admitting that. Where does that get us? Well, it does get us, I think, with a certain amount of humility. And humility before God, humility about our own abilities to know God and to praise God. I wonder if we're 800 years after Maimonides' death, I wonder if, and only you can answer this, you and I haven't made Judaism too easy. We've made it easy, or have we made it easy, by saying that we know what God is thinking, that we can make deals with God. You get observance, I get, well, I don't know, whatever it is that I want, a BMW or whatever, a promotion or the Cubs winning the World Series or whatever. But look, that we can make a deal with God, that we have a warm, fuzzy, cuddly conception of God that we can snuggle up to. If that's the kind of conception of God we've got, then according to Maimonides, we've made God too accessible to us. And the price that we pay for making God too accessible to us is that we have made God too much like us. We've made God too familiar. It is a commandment, it's a divine commandment, both to love God and to fear God. I wonder, you tell me, making God too accessible, too warm, too friendly, we haven't sacrificed the feeling of awe or fear, the feeling of humility, the feeling of love, all of the things that Maimonides is talking about. If the answer to that question is yes, I'm not going to dictate the answer, but if you feel that the answer is yes, then we are as much in need of his leadership today as people were 800 years ago when he lived. Now, it doesn't take a genius to see that if he's right about Judaism, if this understanding of Judaism as a system of thought is correct, Judaism is difficult. This is a tough religion. Why? Because we are asked to worship and to love something that we cannot see, that we cannot form a mental or a graven image of, that we cannot control, and if Maimonides is right, that we can't even understand. So if you ask yourself the question, where is Maimonides taking us? I mean, give me just a sort of a concrete explanation. Where does all of this lead? If you're right, what do I have to look forward to? A good answer, I think, would be the end of the book of Job. Because in the end of the book of Job, and I don't mean the absolute end where he gets rewarded three times over. What I'm talking about is right after he's heard the voice out of the whirlwind. And he realizes the utter majesty and transcendence of God. Amidst this vast universe that is much greater for him and that it is is much beyond his comprehension. And at that point, he is reduced to silence. Again, for Maimonides, the only true form of praise. He's reduced to silence, and in effect, he repents. Judaism is to take us to that kind of feeling, that kind of reflection, that kind of feeling of awe and humility in front of God. That's Maimonides' message. And if we don't experience that, then, as I said at the beginning, we have a problem. Well, it is a tough religion, and it was always meant to be a tough religion, and that's why there are both successes and failures and peaks and valleys. I'm going to end this lecture now by quoting a very little-known Jewish thinker, somebody that I doubt that anybody in this audience has ever read, and that's my grandmother. And whenever I would talk to her and say about Judaism, going to cheder and everything else, you know, Bubby, this is tough. She would look back at me and say, Shver Zayin a Yid. Okay? So that's the message of my... Yes, it's a tough religion, and it's always going to be a tough religion. And that's where Maimonides thinks we are. Thank you.
What we'll do is we'll take two questions only. The rest of the questions we'll do at 2:15. Remember, we're having a panel after lunch. We'll have an hour and a half, an hour and a quarter, whatever, to deal with issues. But we will take two questions of 30 seconds each, please. No statements, just questions. So if you want to come to the mic, one and two, and that's it.
I got one question. It was an excellent lecture, but...
Thank you.
Where do you put Maimonides of the Shmunah Prakim of 8 chapters? It's a totally different Maimonides than you are describing. Thanks.
Is the Maimonides of Shmunah Prakim totally different? No, I don't think it's totally different because part of what's going on in Shmunah Prakim is yes, he's got a psychology, and he's got an account of God's not being material. But remember, you've also got claims to the effect that we can't take literally everything that's in the Torah and everything that's in the prayer book. And Shmona Parakim is not the be-all and the end-all of Maimonides, but I don't see anything in what I've said that's incompatible with the stand that he takes there. I would say that he's trying to do more in the sense that he's trying to talk about human psychology and things like that there, but I don't see any contradiction between that and what I've said here. What I've said here is mainly from the Mishneh Torah and the Guide of the Perplexed and Perek Halakh, but I myself fail to see an incompatibility. Unless I'll be happy to talk to you at, excuse me, greater length over the break.
You mentioned that Maimonides does not believe in prayer. So why?
No, he does believe in it.
So why does he write Hilchas Tefillah?
No. Let me not be misunderstood.
To be silent.
Let me not be misunderstood. He does believe in prayer. Prayer for Maimonides is mandatory. Okay? What he doesn't believe is that everything that occurs in the prayer book can be taken in its literal or external sense. What he thinks is you have to see Judaism and the prayer book as a kind of a learning lesson. Yes, of course, you begin with descriptions of God that make God seem like a king sitting on a throne. He knows that. But what he wants you to see is that this is an educational process. And that part of that educational process is to get you to the point where you recognize that these descriptions of God, this may be the best that we can do in describing God in human terms, but they can't, therefore, be actual or literal descriptions of God. He wants you to see that while prayer is needed, and prayer, again, I emphasize, is mandatory, it isn't all that's needed. In addition to prayer, we need, according to him, to experience that sense of awe, that sense of being silenced that Job had. So it's not saying don't pray. It's just saying recognize that all language, anything that we can express linguistically in some deep, ultimate level, doesn't really describe God. At some deep, ultimate level, we're in the same position of Moses, who was told, you can't see my face. In effect, don't even try. He does believe that God created Adam in his image. What he says there is, again, you can't take image as meaning physical resemblance. All right, let's take just one more minute. Take one example. If I say that boy over there is the image of his father, that implies physical resemblance. Now, suppose I said that police officer over there is the image of valor. Of valor. What would that? It certainly doesn't mean, I don't think, that valor has two eyes and two ears and a nose. I'm using image in a broader or looser sense. So, says Maimonides, when the Torah says that Adam was created in the image of God, it doesn't mean that there's a physical resemblance. All it means is that unlike all the other animals in the animal kingdom, Adam was given the gift to be able to think. That's it. It doesn't mean that Adam's thought can grasp God. It doesn't mean that Adam's thought is comparable to God's. It just means that Adam, unlike everything else in the Garden of Eden, could think. No physical resemblance implied. Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll take a 4.5 minute break again. Okay? Then after our next talk, we'll have lunch. So.